I'm Patricia Camilleri, and in this series called Talking Books, I shall be asking my guests about their personal relationship with the written word. I'm very pleased to have with me today in the studio Dr. Claude Mangione, who is senior lecturer in the Department of Philosophy here at the University. Just a few quick words about Dr. Mangione. His particular philosophical interests are contemporary Western philosophy and communication and cultural theory. Currently, he is writing a book on the philosophy of communication. Welcome, Dr. Mangione.
Thank you for the invite.
When I asked Claude for a book to focus on during this interview, I suppose I wasn't very surprised when he suggested The History of Sexuality, Volume 1, which was, of course, written by Michel Foucault. And I must say, I'm really looking forward to hearing his take on this much-discussed text. One hears a lot about Foucault, and I think that this is a really nice opportunity for me to hear what you have to say about it, because I know that he's obviously one of your favourite authors and philosophers. Perhaps to begin with, you could, philosophically speaking, put Foucault in a bit of a context, to say where he was coming from and where he found himself then during the 70s when he wrote the major part of his books.
Yes. Before starting, discussing a bit the context, the historical philosophical context, just want to mention that the reason why I like this book, why it had attracted me, was because it kind of challenges a lot of the ideas which, at least in Malta, we still think, about certain things being normal and natural. And this book undermines a lot of these things that are considered, when you say something is natural, it seems to justify any norms or rules you want to impose on others. So I found this a bit of an eye-opener. Now, in terms of, to return to the question, in the 1940s, France was dominated by the figure of Jean-Paul Sartre. He was the kind of grand master of philosophy, and Sartre and Sartrean existentialism. And anyone who wanted to be somebody in the French intellectual scene, which is a very dynamic one, kind of positioned himself against Sartre. So Sartre, ended up being criticized by a lot of people, obviously, but take it in their stride. And Foucault, among other thinkers, belonged to he started out with a movement called structuralism, although it's a movement in a broad sense. It's not like they all followed the same thing, but they had certain insights which Foucault and Claude Lévi-Strauss and Jacques Lacan took from one of the founding fathers of structuralism, Saussure. The other father of structuralism or semiology is the American Charles Sanders Peirce. But the Europeans have tended to follow the structuralism of Saussure. And in structuralism, the name is indicative. The emphasis is upon the structures of language, of society, of political systems. And when you say structure, as opposed to the individual. So existentialism, the reaction to existentialism was that of structuralism. Whereas existentialism focused on the human agent, on the individual who created meaning, who created values, who was the origin of everything. Structuralism undermined this idea, which is popular a lot among people, the idea of the individual being unique and the origin of certain ideas and concepts. Structuralists say that there are structures which pre-exist the individual. Doesn't mean the individual is, useless or pointless, but this idea of the origins is undermined. Just one little example. We're born into a language which pre-exists us, and we learn that language as we grow up, and we can use it. So what we say is restricted by the structure of the language we're born into. So we don't invent words. We use a pre-existing structure, vocabulary, syntax, and stuff like this. It's true, we can use language to create new meanings, but they're always subject to what we already have.
That is in itself was quite a novel idea as well. The idea that one was working within a system, and therefore, as you say, that sort of Renaissance idea of the humanistic idea of the person being the central focal point is actually can be quite worrying. I think even you were saying before, some your students sometimes find that a bit upsetting.
Yes, it's true. They like to think of themselves as being, you know, individuals and all in search for meaning. What structuralism has done is it's displaced the emphasis. It's not saying that, you know, people aren't important, they don't count for anything and all this, but it shifted emphasis on the structures. So especially, for example, in the case of meaning, according to the structuralist, you know, the meaning of, let's say, if it's language, of a concept, in its relation to other concepts, other meanings. You know, the meaning of the word man as opposed to woman, as opposed to boy, as opposed to infant, and so on. You know, it's the structure, the totality that takes over. So an individual is a meaningful person in relation and has an identity in relation to others. So in a way, the social communal comes back in, as opposed to existentialism that said the individual is against society, you know, he finds himself by reacting to the morals, the values of the system he belongs to, and stuff like this.
Many of these philosophers, though, did grow differently as they sort of developed their own philosophy. And I think Foucault also developed in a way that as he wrote his books, he sort of expanded his theory and added perhaps other bits and pieces.
That's true. Usually many major figures, there are, in fact, the labels are used, the early, the middle, the later, and depends how many books you wrote. Sometimes it's just, in the case of Foucault, his life, his writings have been classified usually as the archaeological phase, which is the early Foucault, the genealogical phase, and the book we're going to talk about today belongs to the genealogical phase, and the later Foucault is the return to subjectivity, which is characterized by volumes 2 and 3 of The History of Sexuality. So, yes, right, in the case of Foucault, his comment, you know, this has been, he mentions this change, rather he doesn't think of it as a change of direction, but a different perspective on the same issues. For example, he says that in his archaeological phase, he focused mostly on, in the terminology, epistemes, frameworks of knowledge, epistemes, and discourse. That's a key term. In that stage, he was relatively neutral. He claims to be just describing the structures of knowledge in Western cultures, Western civilization. With the genealogical phase, it's not a rejection. Some writers have kind of rejected Wittgenstein. The later Wittgenstein rejects what he said himself in the early Wittgenstein. In the case of Foucault, no. He says his genealogical phase is a supplement to the archaeology. In the genealogy, he's interested in power relations. So the constitution of knowledge, but also in relation to institutions, you know, and people who have power.
These are the key words. I mean, you've mentioned words like genealogy, the archaeology, epistemes. Mm. These are the key words that one nomenclature Foucaultian philosophy.
Foucault,
you have
see
to
any of the
sort of get to know these words because they're the key, literally, to opening the
Once
text.
Once you
really
get those, you've, you know, gone a considerable way towards you know, understanding the text. And you know, you find several commentaries that explain, you know, what these terms mean.
In the case of The History of Sexuality, here again we're talking about the term history and the term sexuality. And he himself has, I gather, a particular angle on both those mm-hmm. words.
Yes. For a start, in the various histories that he's written, you know, for example, The History of Madness, Foucault uses, in The History of Sexuality, uses a different classification. I think, not sure if it's only French, but very different from the way history is divided by historians from, let's say, British universities. Roughly speaking, Foucault focuses on the Renaissance period, which is the 16th century, the 1500s. Then he focused the next chunk of time, or the next episteme, actually, is the classical episteme, the 17th and 18th century, more or less, and the modern episteme, or modern period, the 19th and 20th century. So his studies focus mostly on those three periods, and especially on the last two, the classical episteme and the modern episteme. For example, in a British university, modern would have been the 17th and 18th century, which would have started with Descartes. But in a way, this proves the point made by structuralists that, you know, even how history is cut up is arbitrary according to the institutions in that particular country. And now, in relation to sexuality, which is the focus of his study here, he discusses what he considers two periods in Western discourse. The period which starts with the Confessions, the Middle Ages, and the Council of Trent, where the Church had obliged its followers to go to confession, and the point was there that you confessed your thoughts, your sexual thoughts, within the framework of salvation or damnation, you know. So, and the interesting thing there is that Foucault says the priests, you know, when you went to confess, the priests then started to ask not just what you did, so to speak, your actions, but they wanted to know what was going in your head. What were you thinking about as you performed as you took part in your sexual activities? So in a way, what he's saying is there we start having a kind of mental space, the idea of subjectivity, that there's an interior, an inner life, which kind of is governing or the cause of your external behaviors, something which we don't find with the Greeks. The Greeks and their sexual practices, they just thought of it, so to speak, on the surface, something that people did. And since in ancient Greece, they had a lot of same sex, you know, sex between men, it was never an issue, for example, to deviate a bit, of homosexuality. The Greeks never thought of themselves as homosexuals. Foucault writes that homosexuality began in the 19th century, when a different way of thinking emerged in the 19th century. The fact that, let's say, two men had sex together, the 19th century doctors explained it as they did that, they performed that action because there was something, either genetically, something inside their head, something that made them a different class of persons, a different group. Whereas for the Greeks, it wasn't a question of something interior that made you behave that way. It was just practice on the surface.
Another practice. And
something men did. That doesn't need to be explained by looking into their head or into their family. In the 19th century, there was a lot of discourse on, you know, the blood types. Was it something that, you know, it was in their blood that infected? And so, you can imagine, because they were afraid, these 19th century doctors, psychologists, educationalists, they were afraid it might contaminate the generations of the future. So there's this good section in the book where Foucault says the doctors, judges, educationalists, they felt they were fighting a war to protect the human race, to protect the society from these, you know, infections and stuff like that.
The central concern of the book is Foucault's refuting of what he refers to as the repressive hypothesis.
Yes. The opening lines of the history of sexuality, in fact, refer to this, and they refer to the Victorian age. I think most of us remember that we think of the Victorian age as an age of Puritanism, where, actually, even when I was young, I remember at home we couldn't even say the word sex because it was considered kind of as if
taboo.
Dirty. It was a taboo word. And the Victorian age was this kind of thing where, at least in the popular mind, and of course challenging this, in the popular mind, people associate the Victorian age with, you know, this taboo on anything having to do with sex. And there's this idea, there was also this, that even, you know, the legs of pianos were covered because they looked curvy and they kind of seemed sexual, so that you don't get distracted. So this is the idea that in the Victorian age, sex was taboo. Now, what Foucault says is that while perhaps at the level of everyday life, you know, so among ordinary people, talk about sex was prohibited. At another level, at an institutional level, there was a proliferation of discourses, multiple, he says, multiple discourses, doctors, the police, lawyers, educationalists, psychologists, they all were not only silent about it, obsessed with it because of these dangers to society that it could cause. So he's challenging this idea that sexuality was repressed. And he's challenging it also because at the time of when he was writing this book in the 70s, this was the age of sexual liberation. Everyone thought that to free yourself, you have to, you know, have as much sex as possible. And it's like a new age has begun, a revolution, that the energies that had been repressed by the morality of society have to be freed. And Foucault's argument is that there's nothing to be freed because they were never enslaved in the first place. And the history of sexuality basically is an elaboration of this thesis.
The idea of sex in the Western society, as you're describing, has been certainly in this latest period, the focus has been on the scientific side, the psychological side, the analysis side, whereas the Oriental idea of sex as ars erotica is a completely different picture. And he was sort of looking at these two sides and comparing them really, and finding the Western one wanting, in a sense.
The Western version, in a way, followed the pattern of Western culture in other spheres, you know, this obsession with knowledge. As you mentioned, the Ars Erotica, the Oriental version of sexuality, over there it focuses more on the individual who has a teacher, so to speak, a master or guru, who initiates the person into these mysteries of sexuality. And the point there is the intensity of the experience. How, so to speak, further, it's almost semi, it sounds mystical, how further it can take you. In the West followed a different path. The West, rather than focusing on the intensity of the experience, the pleasures that can be derived, focused on transforming sex into a discourse, into speaking about sex. Sexuality in the West became the object of knowledge. What scientists wrote about, spoke about, what they wanted to understand. And now the interesting thing is how Foucault says this process of transforming desire into discourse, that's one of his favorite lines, started, as I mentioned before, in the Middle Ages with confession, and that in the 19th century, in the 1800s, that's right, became secularized psychoanalysis, where psychoanalysis, you confess, you know, in at least, perhaps mistakenly now, traditional psychoanalysis claimed that all our problems are sexual in origin. So you go to the psychoanalyst, you confess. Now, it's no longer salvation or damnation, but your health. Whether you're healthy or ill. And by talking to the therapist, you're eventually cured. In the West, it's not only psychoanalysis, but whether students in relation to their teachers, couples in relation to counselors. The West concerned itself with accumulating as much knowledge as it could about, you know, what people did with their sexualities, because it wanted to you know, collect data, this desire, this will to knowledge, which is characteristic of the West.
And collect data, not only just for the sake of collecting data, but because it was a wonderful agent of control.
Yes.
As well,
yes.
Really.
In fact, it wasn't only about, you know, this, in fact, this is Foucault's criticism of objectivity. This data was collected because the institutions and the state wanted to intervene into society. Western societies were growing, the populations were increasing. The state wanted to know how to control all these large amount of people. In Western cultures, by the 18th and 19th centuries, the two big problems that had wiped out large chunks of the Western population were the plague and famine. Those had been conquered. There was now food that, you know, the idea that people might be wiped out, that whole community that had been eliminated. New technologies, hygiene, new technologies to grow wheat and all this. So now populations were increasing. So the state wanted to know how to control because of riots and revolutions and all this kind of stuff. And through, by monitoring what people did with their sexuality, by kind of saying that only the heterosexual couple, you know, the man and woman, the couple of children, that's normal, should be allowed. Everything else, or you know, obviously indirectly, when you're saying what is allowed, you're indirectly saying what isn't allowed. So it created a new category, the normal people versus the perverse. Suddenly, perversion became a class of people. Homosexuals were obviously among them. Gay men, what children did with their sexuality. There was a lot of obsession with, you know, educationalists monitoring what kids got up to. And you can see even, Foucault shows how even in schools, how the desks were placed, how the dorms were organized from the architectural spaces, it's obvious that they were very concerned with making sure they can keep an eye on the young boys in the schools. Hysterical women. Hysteria suddenly appeared to be an issue because, you know, women were the bearer of children, you know, the future of the society. So you can't have women who are, you know, a bit, I don't know, crazy or something like this. And I think sodomy was the other area of concern. So the state, by monitoring and obviously locking up people who didn't fall into the pattern of the norm or sentencing them and stuff like this, it could control the population.
Gender as such, the position of women within Foucault's ideas about sexuality, where do they fit in?
Feminists, that's one of the criticisms of feminists, that it seems it's very male-oriented, that he doesn't seem to take into account the role of women in Western sexuality and stuff. And that seems to be true, because he doesn't talk about women specifically. So maybe if there's, you know, a failing, well, but perhaps, you know, then there are feminists who have developed Foucault's ideas. There's one, Amy Richter, I think, she attacks Foucault, you know, she ends her article, you know, Forget Foucault, because she's obviously, she's a classicist and a feminist. And she points out how when he gives an example, Foucault gives an example of a young boy in France, a simpleton, who used to pay girls to have sex with them. And Foucault focuses, because this young boy, when he was caught, he was sent for the rest of his life to jail. So, and this is, again, Foucault describes these as harmless pleasures that take place in every village in France in the 80s. And, you know, he ended up, the people studied him and all this kind, you know, all the experts went to see, and the rest of his life in jail, and he was a simpleton. And he said, you know, why so much drama about one boy? And, you know, and the feminist writes that, you know, he never mentioned about, he never spoke about what happened to the girls or how they thought of the whole situation and stuff like this. It depends on how much weight you want to give to that story. But anyway.
That period of French philosophy, the 70s, there's a long list of French philosophers of that, yeah, of that period, the 70s. What is it about France that has created that kind, yeah, of the Derrida?
And still seems to create, it must be their educational system. They seem to just produce. In France, there's a high value on the kind of the intellectual. They, you know, in the general public seem to be quite also well-educated. They seem to read these texts, which are Derrida, not necessarily easy to read. People are interested in what intellectuals have to say. That's the only explanation I can. It must be the system. They train their students well.
Culturally, perhaps. I mean, somebody like Barthes, who is obviously so in touch with his own body, with his and the way he describes literary things that turn out to sound sensual. There's something terribly non-Anglo-Saxon about them, and something that is very specifically French. I don't know.
It might be a bit of a stereotype, yes, that the Anglo, the British are stiff and formal. Whereas the French are fun-loving.
But even the fact that a book like this, System of Objects, of Baudrillard, written in the 60s, if I remember rightly, translated into English, I think for the first time in 1996, you know, the fact that England, Britain seems to have almost deliberately not sort of wanted to, to jump on the French philosophical ideas.
To be fair, that they have their own tradition,
mm-hmm.
the analytic tradition of philosophy, which is, you know, quite widespread in the English-speaking world, many, especially ex-colonies. Though strangely enough, when I was in Denmark, I would have thought Denmark, being part of Europe, you know, literally stuck to it, would have been more continentally inclined. But their departments, they seem to do a lot of analytic philosophy. So, you know, I thought that was odd. And even in Sweden, the Scandinavians, I thought, how can. But so. For some time, I thought it was overrated. There was this kind of rivalry. People spoke about the conflict between analytic and continental philosophers. Nowadays, I think there's more a desire to mend the bridges, bring them together rather than focus on what's different. The problem is sometimes you get the well-known people in both traditions, who act a bit like drama queens, you know, and it is bad publicity, all this help, so they have these loud and perhaps sometimes rude, they're rude to each other, they insult each other, and that tends to cover up, people tend to notice these things, the insults and stuff like this, and they don't see perhaps where those people who have what they have in common. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, I think the common angle is being worked upon by a lot of people. For example, Habermas from the German tradition uses a lot of analytic philosophy in his theory of communicative action. Personally, I like to think that I like the metaphor of cross-fertilization, that each can learn from each other.
Well, Dr. Claude Mangeron, thank you very, very much for coming to talk to us about Foucault today. And I hope that our discussion will stimulate somebody to go and pick up the book and read it, because you've made it sound really, really exciting. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My guest today was Dr. Claude Mangeron. I do hope that you'll be able to join us again for Talking Books next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.